Jeff and I are thrilled to have Dr. Mike Moffitt on the Pivot podcast today. Mike is a senior director of the Smart Prosperity Institute of Canada and was also Canada's first chief information fellow in our federal government, amongst many other accomplishments. Welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Pleasure having you. Mike, let's get right into what Smart Prosperity is and your function within this organization.
Sure. So Smart Prosperity is housed at the University of Ottawa, and we have three big functions. The first is the Smart Prosperity Leaders Initiative. So we have some of Canada's top CEOs, civil society leaders, all come together and try and figure out how to accelerate clean economic growth. And that's what we're all about at Smart Prosperity, of how to drive better environmental and better economic outcomes. We have an academic research network of 150 academics all across the world, about two-thirds in Canada, who research a variety of clean growth topics. And then we have the Policy Shop, which is a think tank of, I think we're about 22 researchers right now who look at all kinds of clean growth topics. So I run that, and we look at everything from agriculture. So what are various agricultural methods we could use to both improve environmental outcomes and get better yields for farmers, to green bonds, to decarbonizing steel, to you name it. And again, it's all around this idea of the environment and the economy coming together.
It seems like politically anyway, if you look at what's happening in the U.S. and certainly subsequent to Canada's announcement of the federal budget, which we're going to get into in a moment, that this is very much at the forefront of our public policy at this time. But this is not a new, some of these ideas and concepts are not new. They've been around for many, many, many years. When I first met you and just, you know, thinking about yourself, what brought you into this space and what brought you to Smart Prosperity?
It was a bit of a pivot for me. I mean, my space had been traditionally in innovation. I've done a lot of work in manufacturing, that, you know, those sorts of areas. So trying to figure out how to get manufacturers and other companies more productive, more innovative, and so on. I saw this as a particularly interesting opportunity because we know we and all other sort of countries around the world have these targets around greenhouse gases, but also other environmental targets, you know, water quality and that kind of thing. And in my view, the only way that we're going to be able to hit those targets in an economically sensible way is through innovation, is through coming up and deploying the new technologies in order to allow us to decarbonize. So it's a particularly interesting problem to me. I mean, my other sort of job, I'm a business professor at Ivy Business School that does work on economic policy and innovation. So it seems like, okay, we've got this big, you know, existential challenge on the environment. What is the role for business and policymakers, you know, to develop the technologies and to deploy the technologies to, you know, help us hit those targets?
There was a lot in there, Mike, but I'm wondering if we can at least spend a little bit of time up front. I'd love to hear your opinion. So you just hit on, you know, what can we do from a policy standpoint? So sometimes I'm just thinking, you know, what can governments do? I find myself frequently in conversations with just friends and family about this, and someone will say something along the lines of, well, it's about time government does something. And I always like to ask the question, well, what exactly do you want them to do, and what exactly can they do? Can we elaborate on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a difficult issue. And I do think one of the worst things that we can do is make policy for the sake of making policy. You know, this idea of something must be done, this is something, so let's do it. I think there's a role for all levels of government. So, you know, the federal government, for instance, has a lot of tax tools and other policies that they can use at sort of a broad level. A lot of the action happens at the provinces. Most labor market policies are at the provinces, you know, provinces do education, healthcare, and so on. And then municipalities, you know, municipal governments through buildings and transit and those sorts of things. So there are a variety of things that the governments can do, but they're also somewhat limited, right? We don't have, you know, government doesn't build all the buildings itself in a capitalist society. It doesn't make decisions about, you know, what businesses are going to run and where and so on, and we wouldn't want them to. So my view is the role for government is to set the market conditions and set the overall framework, set the sort of rules of the game to allow businesses and entrepreneurs and the market to solve those problems without, you know, again, sort of dictating in sort of a classic sort of Soviet style. Okay, you know, this is where this factory is going to be and so on.
So I would want to spend some time. I'm really happy you touched on, and I knew we would, of course, innovation in the private sector and all those things. But I want to linger a little bit longer on the government side of things. So I'm curious to why it seems to me that – so let's just use carbon tax as an example, okay? I don't know if you have the same things being recommended to you from a social media standpoint, but I don't see a lot of positive commentary on things like carbon tax or pricing carbon or, you know, whatever we want to actually call this from a, you know, government standpoint and a messaging standpoint. But it just seems to me like, you know, something has to be done here, but we seem completely incapable of having a healthy conversation around it. Why do you think that is?
Well, it's naturally a difficult problem. Like, everybody wants emissions to go down. You know, you ask sort of anybody, and, you know, there's polling on this. You say, okay, you know, should we get emissions down in general? And when you talk about it in these sort of vague generalities, you get 80, 85, 90% support. We're all sort of there. It's then when you get into the specifics of how, you get a lot less support, because then at that point, the sort of costs of action become a little bit more apparent, right? People go, okay, well, I'm going to have to pay more for gasoline. I'm going to have to pay more for this, pay more for that. And naturally, people don't like that. And you can sort of understand why. But the carbon tax is a particularly useful tool. In part because it changes the sort of relative prices, that without pricing carbon, you're essentially giving carbon a subsidy. You're essentially giving polluting activities a subsidy because they're not paying for that full cost of pollution. So you can use the carbon tax as a tool to sort of level the playing field and allow those sort of new technologies give them space, right? That go, okay, well, if we price the pollution from driving, then electric cars start to become more attractive and people sort of make that investment. So it's a way of sort of leveling the playing field and allowing consumers to make the best decisions for them without sort of dictating. Because the government could very well say, okay, you know what, we're just going to ban the internal combustion engine and everybody has to buy an electric car. But, you know, we would prefer our governments not be that heavy-handed. We would prefer to allow individual consumers and businesses to make the choices that are best for them. So a carbon price is a way of doing that, saying, okay, you know, if an electric car doesn't work for you, that's fine. You know, you're just going to have to pay for the pollution you create. So it's a very effective tool to drive innovation because it makes polluting activities relatively more expensive than non-polluting activities.
Mike, the federal government announced a budget a few weeks ago, and there were a lot of details in regards to clean tech that I know you did some advocacy work for. Can you, at a high level, just touch upon what you think are some of the more pertinent aspects as it relates to clean tech that are built into the budget and some of the things that you advocated for that you were successful in, what things you were happy with that were aspects of the budget, and maybe some things that it maybe could be expanded upon for future consideration?
Sure. So this was a budget with a whole lot of different things in it. This was this may be the largest budget in terms of just sheer page numbers in Canadian history. I don't know if that's entirely true, but I believe it to be. So there's a lot in here. There's a few different policies I like on clean tech. One of my favorite is a corporate tax cut for zero emissions manufacturers. So the idea behind it is if you manufacture a technology in Canada, you will pay significantly lower corporate tax rates. Normally the corporate tax rate is 15%. If you're producing solar panels or windmill blades or electric vehicles or the batteries that go in the electric vehicles, your corporate tax rate is cut to 7.5%. And the idea behind that, they're trying to accomplish a couple things here. The first is to attract foreign direct investment, to get international manufacturing companies to set up shop in Canada, attracted by the relatively lower corporate tax rate. But they're also trying to get the development of startups and scale-ups in Canada to get capital to them. The idea being that if you're an investor and you're looking at a scale-up company, now, if you know that their corporate tax rates are going to be low and their future stream of profits are going to be taxed at a reduced rate, that makes that investment more attractive today. So it's, in dollar terms, it's relatively a small thing for the government, but it should drive a fair bit of investment. So that's one particular one I like. There's other ones around clean tech adoption. So changing of accelerated capital cost allowance, basically for a variety of clean tech technologies. If you're if you buy one of these technologies as a company, you can write off the full expense 100%. You don't have to sort of depreciate it over time. This is something we had before, but they basically extended the list of technologies. There's a bunch of other things in there that I like as well. But you also asked me about something that I was sort of disappointed not to see in there. And one is an investor tax credit into clean tech. A number of provinces have this, British Columbia, for example. So basically in British Columbia, if you make an angel investment into a qualifying clean tech startup or scale up, you get an additional tax credit on that. And the idea is that it drives angel investment into these startup and scale up companies. There was talk of doing this at the federal level. It didn't make it into the budget. I would like to see it. I think there's a lot of investors in Canada who would like to be able to support our clean tech startups and scale ups. This would be a way to drive capital into that market.
Yeah, and as it relates to, I suppose, repatriating the supply chain when it comes to homegrown players, how do you see this kind of correlating or squaring with the clean tech sector?
Yeah, well, I think the government's already, the federal government and provincial governments as well, have been trying to repatriate some of these investments and as well, scale up our existing companies. So, we've seen over the last, I'd say, year or so in Ontario, announcements from Ford and General Motors on investments in electric vehicles in southern Ontario that will be starting up in a few years. We saw an announcement of the federal government's invest in battery technology in Quebec and trying to sort of scale that up. And this is something across the coast. I know in Atlantic Canada, we're seeing investments in carbon capture and storage in Newfoundland. We're seeing investments in tidal energy. There's a lot. We talk about clean tech as sort of this sort of overarching industry, but there's a lot of little sub industries in it that are located in different parts of Canada, each with their sort of own needs. And again, we've got in this budget, we got some tools from the federal government to help these companies grow. But I do think more needs to be done.
I was really happy to hear you say, or at least begin to look at this from an investor's perspective. I can't explain why this would be my intuition, but it always has been. It seems to me that the private sector will likely get us out of this, or at least in some large capacity. I think this at least partially relates to a previous comment I made, with regards to our inability to have a healthy conversation about this, perhaps a lack of trust in, government moving funds into the adequate areas. Sometimes I kind of laugh. During the heat of the pandemic, I had seen a meme that was circulating, and it had said, "Listen, is there a tax I can pay to get rid of COVID, or does that only work with climate change?" And I'll admit, I kind of chuckled, and then I quickly thought to myself, man, I hope no one is taking this seriously. But at the same time, I don't think we are looking at this from a private sector standpoint, I know people like yourself are, and people in industry, of course, are, but I don't think the regular person in Canada is really looking at it from that point. And I always thought, man, it would be wonderful if we could stumble upon some great technology that not only helps the world and us, but it's also extremely profitable. Yeah. And then the market can just kind of handle this. So I'm wondering if we could, you know, lead into that with regards to talking about some specifics about where clean tech is going right now, some of the technologies perhaps that we've already mastered or have a good understanding of, and where this is all going.
Sure. So absolutely, I am 100% with you. And I think the way we're going to generate more support across Canada for hitting our targets is if we get out of this sort of sacrifice narrative, right? That climate action means that we're going to have to, you know, pay more for gas, or we're going to have to stop eating steak or what that is, and recognize that, you know, there's a lot of opportunity here for jobs and economic activity. And if people see this as a way to, you know, for instance, revitalize our manufacturing sector and can see the jobs that are getting created, I think we'll have far more support for those transitions that are taking place. And again, I would look at this as sort of a regional level. So, you know, I'm from Southwestern Ontario. I'm from London, Ontario. Grew up near Ford Talbotville, which was an old Ford plant near St. Thomas, Ontario. You know, for Southwestern Ontario, this really means automotive, right? With that, we have, we have General Motors and Ford and others talking about making electric vehicles, all the sort of spin-off parts that are going to sort of get created from that. We have companies in Southwestern Ontario that do a lot of sort of water technologies, that kind of thing. So, you know, there is a real role here. And again, it's all going to get, you're absolutely right, that's all going to get driven by the private sector, by companies making decisions, sort of reading the tea leaves, seeing where the market's going, and investors investing in those companies. And what government can do is create the conditions for success. And that could be anything from, again, tax to labor market policies that we haven't talked about to, you know, make sure that companies can get access to skilled labor. In Alberta, you know, this looks like carbon capture and storage. This looks like hydrogen. You know, we're seeing, pilot projects to turn the output of the oil sands into clean burning hydrogen. We're seeing carbon cure, you know, sort of low carbon cements at the East Coast. We're seeing hydrogen. We're seeing, modular nuclear reactors. There's a lot of different things. And some of these technologies are not going to pan out, you know, and I think, you know, we need to understand that that's okay. We're going to have to try a bunch of different things. You know, investors are going to put their money in a variety of different places, just like they did in the dot-com era. A lot of these are going to end up being busts, but, we're going to hit the sort of few lottery tickets and develop those technologies to get us out of there. But it's going to have to come from the free market. It's going to have to come from investors investing in these companies developing these technologies, making these sales, and so on. That's the only way we're going to get out of it. Government is not going to be able to sort of pick the one or two technologies to get us out of it, and that's going to solve everything. That just simply will not work.
Mike, from a market size perspective of Canada relative to the world, I mean, we're a very small, GDP-wise, a pretty small country, but we've never lacked for ambition. Clearly in this space, you know, we're breaking a lot of new ground. Who do you look to, or who does this sector kind of look to from a global perspective in terms of what gets them excited and inspiration and ideas and innovation?
Well, I think our manufacturing, our tech manufacturing is going to be an export industry. I mean, if we look at automotive or any of our traditional manufacturing industries, you know, they tend to export 85 to 90% of what they do, mostly to the United States. So, you know, that's where our market opportunity is going to be. You know, we have one of the two largest global economies right next door. It's a huge market. Now, with a change in the administration in the United States, that, you know, now they're trying to hit climate targets as well. It's created this huge sort of market opportunity. But we're also looking to other countries for ideas on how to accelerate the sort of production of these technologies. The Germans, for example, are very, very good at this. They take a real partnership approach between government and business, where, you know, again, businesses are ultimately the ones driving this. Businesses are the ones making the exports, but they're working with government to, you know, make sure that the infrastructure is in place to get this to market. They're working with the colleges and the universities, the Fraunhofer Institutes, in order to, you know, co-develop these technologies to make sure that there's a pool of skilled labor. I think that is going to be a real bottleneck in Canada, that our manufacturing industries are getting quite old. You know, a lot of older workers, there's going to need to be some turnover. And we're already seeing shortages in the skilled trades, you know, in manufacturing and construction and so on. So, you know, developing that next generation of workers in these industries is going to be absolutely vital. And that's going to have to involve businesses and governments and educational institutions all working together, all sharing a common vision. The Germans do this very well. The Koreans do it well. The Japanese do it well. So there are these international countries that we can look to for inspiration.
Mike, you've spent a lot of time in the classroom. You've got a PhD level education. From an academic perspective or from a reskilling perspective, when we think about the modern economy, what are some of the skills and traits that you feel for younger people looking to get into this space or looking, maybe middle-aged people looking to reskill themselves because maybe their skills have become redundant or maybe they've been automated? What do you see as some opportunities in this space?
Yeah, so we're starting to see that already. I mean, the both federal and provincial governments here in Ontario have really been focusing on that sort of middle age, career change occupation through things like micro credentials, right? So instead of having a sort of 4-year degree, these smaller programs to help people upskill. At SPI, we're actually undergoing a research project right now looking at what are the skills needed in a decarbonizing economy. And one of the things that surprised us was, you know, we were sort of looking at the literature, looking, you know, talking to companies, seeing what people need. And yes, STEM skills are important, you know, your science, your technology skills, and so on. But what we're actually finding at a lot of our manufacturers and so on is that, you know, a lot of the sort of the floor tasks, the tasks on the shop floor are highly automated, right? So, you know, the sort of traditional 1970s style, you know, big factories with people on these assembly lines are largely gone. They're not coming back. What the skills that are needed now are a lot of softer skills. There are things like problem solving skills, like what do you do when the, you know, machine breaks down and you're not, you know, you're not quite sure what's going on. So we're finding problem solving skills, communication skills, interpersonal skills to be exceptionally important. So, you know, and that's one of the messages that we're trying to work with both our federal and provincial counterparts on, is not to neglect those. That yes, you know, it's important to have a bunch of people who know how to weld, who know how to fix electronics and so on, but we also need to teach them all of these sort of complementary skills in order to sort of compete in a 21st century economy.
You just alluded to the Smart Prosperity Institute and, you know, some of the work that you guys are doing. I'm very curious if you had any specific recommendations for where either, you know, Marcel and myself or some of our listeners could go look on the Smart Prosperity Institute and which research publications or anything like that you think would be a great place for people to start having a greater understanding of some of the things we're discussing today.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's again a few things that we do. We had a big innovation report about 3 or 4 years ago that looked at the sort of overarching, you know, how do countries become more innovative in a clean economy sense. So that's a nice place to start. And then after that, we really sort of focus sort of sector by sector. So we do a bunch of work in agriculture, for instance. We have a number of reports on clean agriculture and the role of that innovation can play there. We've had a number of reports on green bonds for those investors interested in the bond market. You know, what are the trends? What are the trends when it comes to green bonds? Another area that we do a lot of work on is a circular economy. So circular economy is basically considering the whole life cycle of production and a product. So basically, how can you reduce material waste? And that's a particularly important area, we think, for businesses as well, because that, you know, that waste obviously has environmental consequences, but it's also a cost, right? It's a cost of business. If you're, if you're generating that waste, that you're essentially sort of paying for that next year sort of materials. So how can we reduce the material usage of our companies, which both helps their profitability, but also helps the environment. So there's a lot of different reports. We do a lot of different things. So it's a very sort of content rich environment, but please check out our website. I think you'll find something there that you'll like.
I'm sure we all will find something there. And in fact, I admit I found it a little overwhelming, which is why I asked the question. There was just so much in there. I am curious if I can move the conversation a little bit of another direction, not entirely, but you're coming at this obviously from a very academic standpoint with your background. I understand fundamentally you're an economist, but you've also had some exposure to, Smart Prosperity Institute, you're an economist, you're a professor, but my understanding is you are also an economic advisor to Justin Trudeau. Am I correct there?
You are correct. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering if you could share some learnings through that experience, or if you feel that all of these different experiences are complementary, or if they're fact. You know, I'm just wondering if you can expand on this. I'm sure everybody would be interested to hear that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been lucky. I've done a lot of different things in my career. I've also worked in industry. I worked in the chemical industry for a number of years, and they all absolutely are complementary. So. On the political advisory side, between 2013 and 2015, I was an economic advisor to Justin Trudeau. I helped with the Liberal platform in 2015. And I found it an interesting experience because I think one of the things that academics often do is, you know, we can come up with something that looks great on a blackboard or great on an Excel sheet, but it doesn't sort of work in the real world. I mean, either it would just be so unpopular that, you know, a politician couldn't sell it, or you don't have the sort of administrative capacity within the federal government, provincial government, whatever government you're advising or political party you're advising. So I found it interesting to see how the sort of other side, you know, the sort of political side thinks about these problems. And, you know, I was always told, all of us who are sort of outside academic advisors to Justin Trudeau, we're always said, okay, you know, don't worry about the politics, don't worry about the strategy. That's sort of our side. You know, just explain to us the sort of economics of it. But it was, and we'll ask the questions. And I found that the conversations that I'd have with Trudeau and with the people around him really got me thinking about, again, what are the sort of, you know, limits? What are the sort of constraints that we don't think about so much on the academic work? And that's been incredibly helpful to me over the last 6 years, since I stopped or since the 2015 election, because I sort of, again, understand better those real world constraints. And I think that's made the advice that I give to politicians and other policymakers a little bit more implementable, you know, like it's things that they can actually do. I find the advice or the types of policies I create now are easier to implement. They're not quite as complicated, don't have quite as many moving parts, which I think is beneficial. So I've been very lucky. I got the sort of extra education that most of my peers haven't been able to get, and I do think it's, you know, I hope I was helpful to them But they were certainly helpful to me in being able to sort of design better public policy.
I'm just wondering if we can expand on that a little bit more. So I love the word real world constraint, particularly as someone who's gone to school for so long. So I have an undergrad, I have an MBA, and various professional designations. And I don't remember being in my undergrad when I was, 18, 19, 20, and hearing a whole lot of conversation around real world constraints. Okay. It was very theoretical what was being taught to me. It didn't matter the subject, actually, across the board, this was the case. I'm just curious if you could share some insight to how you are discussing these real world situations with your students.
Yeah, well, it certainly comes up when we talk about public policy. So, give you an example. We have one policy on the carbon price that we have is the carbon rebates, or at least in certain provinces that don't have their own system. So the idea is that we all get sort of a rebate check back, without sort of considering the sort of real world constraints, that would be the end of the conversation. It's like, okay, what are we going to do with the carbon price money? Oh, we'll just rebate it back to people. It's like, okay, end of conversation. But once you start thinking about the real world constraints, it's like, okay, well, how are you going to do that, right? Like, that money doesn't magically appear back in people's pockets just because the government says so, right? They need to have some kind of mechanism to get it back to them. So it's like, okay, well, we'll do it through the tax system, right? It's like, okay, when people file their tax returns, we'll give them money back to them that way. And it's like, well, okay, but not everybody files a tax return. How are you going to deal with those issues? How are you going to deal with the issues around indigenous issues? How are you, again, on this sort of tax return issue? What are you going to do for people who pay carbon price who aren't necessarily paying Canadian taxes? There's all of these sort of edge cases that become important that you wouldn't really think about if you were just doing this as an exercise in Microsoft Excel, where you're saying, okay, here's the amount of money I'm bringing in and here's how I get it back to people. Like, all of these sort of mechanisms matter. And I think we've learned that during the pandemic. Like, we've had all of these programs, to help support individuals and support businesses to get through the pandemic. And the question that's often asked is like, okay, well, why are these kind of so kludgy and so complicated? But then when you go and look at the systems, it's like, okay, well, actually, the government doesn't know where any one person is at any given time, right? They don't know exactly who's alive, who's dead. There's all of this sort of administrative stuff that goes on in the background and can make something that a policy that might look really good on paper really hard to implement in practice.
Mike, you mentioned something earlier about the, coveted skills that you're looking for in this sector, and you touched on communication and many would say some of the softer skills that would be essential to be successful. In your learnings of interacting with government and communicating with government, what were your learnings? Because I touched on it earlier, but there's no course or to prepare you for how to talk to Justin Trudeau or his peers. But what changed between the time you initially started interacting with public officials to where you ended up at prior to exiting?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is being respectful of their time. Like, academics, we tend to write and talk in these, long paragraphs and sentences, sort of jargon filled. Being able to get to the point and being able to express complex ideas in a straightforward way. I'm still trying to master how to do this, but it's so incredibly important. And it's something that I actually try and do as a professor. I find in college and in university, we're training students with the wrong skills. We're training students to write these like 20, 30, 40 page papers. And in the real world, that's not particularly valuable. So what I've been trying to do with my students is get them to instead explain something to me in 2 pages maximum. Can you explain this to me in a PowerPoint presentation rather than an essay? I this is something I've been trying to get across to my peers in academia when we're teaching students, is try and figure out how to be concise and how to teach your students how to be concise, because it's a really valuable skill to have.
Can you describe, because when we first connected, you talked about the fact that when prior to a budget being released, you're one of a select few that actually has a chance to absorb the information and transcribe it in a way from a communication standpoint. Can you talk about just that experience and obviously pre-pandemic and what that's like?
Yeah, so every year there's at both the federal and provincial level, there's called a budget lockup, and it's exactly what it sounds like. So here in Ottawa, where I am right now, usually they have, pre-pandemic, they have a variety of different stakeholders. So the media, for instance, but also, the head of government relations for a variety of different companies and trade associations and so on. They get to see the budget before everyone else. Normally, the budget comes out at 4 p.m. So what they do in the lockup is you apply for this thing, and if you're lucky enough to get in, you go to a sort of large conference center where you're allowed to bring your laptop, but there's no Wi-Fi, and they take away your phone because they don't want you leaking sensitive budget information before everybody else gets to see it, just because some of the stuff in there could at least theoretically move markets. So you go maybe 9 or 10 a.m., you get a printed copy of the budget and then an electronic copy and a USB key where you get to sort of pore over it, see what's in there, if you're a journalist, write your article. If you're sort of the head of a government relations for a firm, write a summary note on your laptop. And then at 4 p.m., when the world gets access to the budget, the Wi-Fi comes back on, and then boom, you can send this thing out to the world. So I've been to a number of them, both federally and provincially, and they're quite interesting. Because you have a lot of reporters and a lot of analysts, sharing notes, looking over these things. And as someone who spends a lot of time on social media, I actually find that the hardest thing. Like it feels like a return to like the 1990s or so, because you can't check your phone, you can't check your email, you have no access to the outside world. I remember years ago, I went to a federal one in Ottawa, and I showed up a little bit late. And this idea, you can show up whenever you want, you just can't leave until 4 p.m. So I was one of the last people in, and I had found out just like 30 seconds before that Rob Ford, the former mayor of Toronto, had passed away. And I ended up breaking that news to a room full of journalists who were kind of itching that they couldn't write this story, right? Because they didn't have any sort of details to it about it, and they were sort of locked up. So it's a very weird environment where you're in this room for 6 or 7 hours and you have no access to the outside world whatsoever, in a room full of people who are complete news junkies and would otherwise constantly be on their phone or on Twitter.
Yeah, all great points. I think the break from your phone is probably a good thing overall. It certainly would be for me. We've had you for a while now. Just a couple questions left to wrap things up here. It didn't matter what topic we talked about today. What I noticed for you was just a tremendous amount of passion. Okay. Can you give us some sense of how you became so passionate about perhaps clean tech or economics generally?
Yeah, well, I don't think anybody ever grows up dreaming of being an economist. And I certainly didn't. I wanted to either be a detective or a baseball player when I was a kid. And I realized quite early that my baseball skills were not going to get me to the expos. I kind of just fell into this. I took a lot of different things at college and university, and I've had sort of a number of jobs and a number of opportunities. But I absolutely love this stuff, because I just think that this is, sort of the defining issue of our time. It's the thing that 100 years from now, people will be talking about our generation's ability or inability, if this turns out badly, to deal with climate change. So it helps me get up in the morning, say, okay, well, you know, what small role can I play in all of this? And I just see so much opportunity there. I really, you know, and I've mentioned this a few times, I don't think this necessarily has to be a story about us all sort of sacrificing things, that there's a massive global market opportunity for these technologies to help get the world out of this mess. So anything I can do, you know, to either help my students or help companies develop these technologies, you know, that makes for a good day.
That's just a great message of positivity to end the podcast on. But I do have one question remaining. You're our first guest who has a Wikipedia page. Do you ever go on that thing and make sure everything's accurate?
Well, it's right. My wife goes on every so often, and she'll tell me about something that was either accurate or not accurate. But yeah, no, it's funny. Again, I'm a guy. I grew up in London, Ontario, you know, in the sort of East End, you know, by a tire rim factory. You know, I'm just some blue collar kid. So being able to, you know, having this career where, you know, I worked with Justin Trudeau, I've got a Wikipedia entry, just, it absolutely blows my mind again, because I still see myself as that blue collar kid from London, Ontario. So you know, what little I've achieved in my career still haven't quite wrapped my head around.
Yeah, I feel the same at times, to be honest. Listen, we'll wrap it up there. Thanks so much. This was just a great conversation. Really appreciate you joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Mike.